Today on Maine Calling, the need for nuance. Don't we all crave certainty? After all, it's so alluring, the idea of being able to break things down into black and white, good and evil, right and wrong, knowing where you stand on every little issue you confront. If only it were so easy. The real world is full of nuance, but it's hard, especially in our polarized society. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk about the gray area and embracing nuance in a productive way. What does it take to think with more nuance? And how can that improve communications when it comes to politics, the workplace, and personal relationships? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In so many aspects of life, we take sides. We frame issues as this or that, right or wrong, black or white. Well, today we're going to talk what's in between, you know, the gray area. How can we communicate with more nuance in order to find common ground? Joining me, Aria Kruglansky is a social psychologist and distinguished professor at the University of Maryland, and Judith Rosenbaum, associate professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you find yourself feeling uncomfortable in the gray area? Do you want to better communicate nuanced ideas but have trouble? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us. Professor Kruglansky, I will start with you. We are talking about, as we said, the need for nuance and embracing the gray area, but that's not always easy. And you come at this from a psychological perspective. So I want to ask if certain people are more, predisposed to being nuanced, and certain people are more predisposed to being black and white thinkers. Are some people hardwired that way? What do you think?
Yes, we have evidence, in fact, that there are individual differences in what we call the need for cognitive closure, the need for certainty. So, people vary. There are some genetic differences. There are some socialization differences. Cultures differ in how much premium they put on clarity and precision. The German culture is very precise. The Japanese culture is very precise. Other cultures are more free flowing. The Greek culture, New Zealand, less bound to precision and clarity. Over time, cultures differed in how much premium they put on precision. And there are also situations when uncertainty seems to be very threatening, when it's associated with positive, negative events, people want to escape it and try to avoid nuance and reach closure, presumably a closure that is safe. So when bad things are hovering over the horizon, people try to escape that uncertainty and reach clear-cut conclusions. So both situations, cultures, and personality differences represent conditions under which people would feel uncomfortable with nuance and try to seek certainty.
Professor Kuglansky, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that, you know, the countries that want precision include Germany and Japan and those that are more comfortable with a different way of thinking, a more flexible way of thinking, include Greece and New Zealand. Where do you see the United States as falling in that spectrum?
I think the United States is somewhere in the middle, not as precise as Germany or Japan, but not as free-flowing as Japan, as New Zealand. So, you know, we are kind of culturally in the middle, but I think the situation right now, because there is so much uncertainty concerning the elections, concerning lots of people feel threatened, there is a general predilection for certainty. And unfortunately, that certainty is often offered by negative viewpoints, conspiracy theories that identify some danger, some culprit that needs to be defended against, that needs to be fought against. So the situation now carries a lot of weight in predisposing people to seek certainty.
Judith, part of the reason we're talking about this topic today is that there's a lot of divisiveness in our nation, and it seems to be in some ways about the way people communicate with one another, not only taking sides, but framing it as us versus them. It's obvious with politics, but boy, it spills over to other things too, and it brings things that maybe are not naturally political into the realm of politics. And I'm wondering, from your research, are you seeing this in how people communicate, especially in social media?
Yes, to a certain degree, right? So I always like to frame things in terms of history. So when you look at the history of journalism, there have been numerous eras in American newspaper history where we were extremely not nuanced, right? The yellow newspaper era in the late 1800s is an example that come to mind, or the battles between Hamilton and Jefferson that were so perfectly captured by this musical. So this you know, avoidance of nuance is not new, but I would argue that the way we communicate these days has almost exacerbated that, right? So most of us communicate using technology. So yes, we still have face-to-face conversations, but most folks now talk to family and friends using WhatsApp or text messages or Facebook or Instagram. And so what you see is that people communicate textually. And when you're just using words, or even if you're sitting on a screen on Zoom, you lose some of the richness of face-to-face communication. And so you lose layers of communication, right? Sarcasm gets lost. Humor gets lost, right? Hence all the emojis and the LOLs. But what makes that worse, if you will, is the fact that a lot of our communication is now public or semi-public. So we never know who might see what I posted on my aunt's Facebook page. So instead of us communicating to connect, we're now much more communicating to perform. So to show other people who we are, what group we want to belong to, and what group we don't want to belong to. And so it becomes more of a showing off rather than a trying to connect. And in that desire to show off, we're wanting to stake our claim more clearly than we would if we're just talking face to face and there's no one else really around who might judge us in some way.
And let me ask you something else, Judith, something I've noticed recently, and you know, maybe it's just my own experience, but I want to see. I feel as though there's this idea that everybody has to have an opinion about everything. And people are not comfortable saying, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't ever hear that anymore.
Well, I mean, I don't either. But, you know, between the two of us, we're N equals two. But I do think that in some way that is tied to the extent to which we feel like we're all performing, so that if all of our friends jump on a conversation about something political, we worry that if we say, I don't know, we're going to appear uninformed. We're going to appear less than how we want to seem, right? And so we're so eager to have this positive image with others, right? To create a positive self-impression that we will have opinions on everything and everything we can think of just because we are so afraid of being judged poorly. So again, it ties to this idea that a lot of communication it's no longer about really dialoguing or learning, but it's about showing the world who we are.
It's such an important motivation. I call it the mother of all social motivation, this quest for significance, to stand out, to be important. And especially in our country, you know, we are significance driven. The issue of success, we want to be successful. We want to matter. You know, the American dream of fame and fortune. We are extremely significance driven. And in the age of social media, where everybody's comparing with everybody else, it's particularly exacerbated. And, you know, it's a huge burden to, you know, always stand out, always compete. You know, it has a lot of mental health consequences. People burn out, people mm-hmm. are driven to suicide in case of teenagers and others who feel shamed or feel, you know, that they're inadequate. So I think this motivation to perform, to be outstanding, is a huge psychological factor that drives a lot of what we see in communications and in the culture in general.
And what I would add, I love the points you're making. And what I would add is that, you know, we all went to high school where every single group sat at like their little table at lunchtime. And that's been exacerbated by social media, right? You're either a mommy blogger or you're a Fitspiration influencer. Like, you are this thing, and that is all you can be, and online anyway. And everything you do has to contribute to that identity. And yes. So, yeah, you have to have opinions, and you have to, like you were saying, you have to constantly work on appearing a specific type of way, because, you know, God forbid your likes drop, and because then who are you? And that's a real problem.
Professor Kruglansky, I don't think you need to be an academic to sort of acknowledge that certainty feels good. It feels good to know where you stand and to feel like you know what's right, you know what's wrong. Why do we crave that? And if you could explain why maybe it's not such a good thing to crave that.
Well, I think uncertainty has potentialities. You can explore possibilities. Certainty closes you off. We have a model that explains under what conditions people crave certainty, and that is when uncertainty has negative potentialities. When you think uncertainty, you think negative uncertainty. You think something bad is going to happen. And that has to do with your upbringing, to the extent to which you're optimistic versus pessimistic. People who are optimistic, we find, are willing to embrace uncertainty and explore it, and explore, you know, what can be done differently that was not afforded heretofore. As Rahm Emanuel, White House chief of staff, used to say, don't let any crisis go unexploited, right? Don't let any crisis, any uncertainty go to waste, because uncertainty has potentialities. But some people who fear that the uncertainty is threatening are going to avoid it. And I think now, because uncertainty for most people carries negative potentialities, people crave certainty to a greater extent. Presumably, this is certainty that is positive. So, you know, the best possible case is to have a certainty that allows you to feel significant, to feel that you matter. And many of these conspiracy theories or populist theories not only give you certainty, but give you a place. You're going to find out who is the enemy and what to do about the enemy. So you find a place for yourself by embracing that certainty. So it's, you know, you can have a negative uncertainty, and that's not going to feel very good. If you're certain that you're going to lose, that's not a very wonderful place to be. But I think that many of the narratives today give you both certainty and a place for, you know, for yourself, for your identity, for your significance, for standing out. You're going to be the fighter against those, you know, white replacement theories, or against those, you know, immigrants who are threatening your American identity. So it's a certainty, but imbued with a positive potential.
Professor Rosenbaum, I'm thinking about the idea of nuance and teaching nuance, and also thinking about what I know probably most professors at most universities in the world want, which is to have their students engage in critical thinking. Is nuance really another word for critical thinking?
Yes, to some degree. I mean, one of the things, so I was thinking, like, you know, when we teach public speaking and storytelling and all those classes, one of the things that we actually do in those classes, we have dialogue days where students have to sit in groups and listen to each other. And in those groups, they have to present opposing opinions and talk through them and learn to sit with that discomfort and learn to communicate in a way that is constructive and productive. And I think it's a great activity. I wish we'd had it when I was an undergrad, because to me, listening is key to nuance and key to critical thinking, because when you really listen to what most people are saying, is they're saying, I'm not sure what's going on here and I'm a little scared and I could use some advice. And they're dressing it up in a way that sounds a lot more secure and a lot more look at me being awesome. But when you really listen to what folks are saying, they're looking for affirmation, right? They're looking for someone to listen to them. And that's part of what we try to do in public speaking, is learning to listen to what people are truly saying.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, what it is, I think it's showing mutual respect, civility. So, you know, if you're too certain that your opinion is the correct one, you are putting down the other person who might think slightly differently. So I think, you know, thinking, not asserting your opinion as the absolute truth, but trying to, you know, presenting it as your opinion, but there could be another opinion. Right. You're willing to listen and you're going to negotiate the meaning of things. I think that's part of civility. That's part of respect that you show the other person. And I think that's extremely important in interpersonal relations in general, in communication, interpersonal communication. Right. And I think that when uncertainty becomes extremely threatening, that is lost, because people crave certainty, and that creates the situation of these dichotomies between us versus them, right, demonizing the other side. And, you know, that's very counterproductive and fragmenting of society, tearing our shared reality asunder, and so on. So I think it's listening to one another, as Professor Rosenbaum just pointed out, is part of civility, part of mutual respect. And that's, you know, essential to you know, having a cohesive community.
Right.
Boy, we've just scratched the surface and we have to go to a break. We're discussing the need for nuance on Maine Calling. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the need for nuance. Why so many people speak and think in terms of black and white instead of embracing the gray area, which, let's face it, is reality. Joining me for this hour, Judith Rosenbaum, Associate Professor at UMaine's Department of Communications and Journalism, and R.E.A. Kruglansky, Distinguished University Professor at the University of Maryland and Fellow of the American Psychological Association. Join the conversation. talk@mainepublic.org is our email address. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we get to the calls, I want to bring up one more aspect of this I've been thinking about. R.E.A., how much is our trouble with nuance due to the speed of our culture right now, that we are not comfortable sitting with things, that things happen so quickly, we make decisions so quickly, we communicate with each other right away? What do you think about that?
I think it's right on target. As a matter of fact, in our experimental work, the way to introduce this need for closure, the need for certainty, is to impose time pressure on people. Mm-hmm. Once you impose time pressure on people, they begin to think in very dichotomous ways. And one, you know, they kind of latch onto whatever is accessible, including stereotypes, as opposed to investigating the individual cases. They latch onto stereotypes. So if you have an ethnic stereotype, a gender stereotype, an age stereotype, under time pressure, you're more likely to judge an individual based on that stereotype. So the speed, the time pressure, the fact that you need to respond quickly enhances that tendency to latch on to what is accessible, what seems to be in the public domain or on your mind at the moment, rather than exploring things in greater depth deliberately and so forth. So speed is really essential, and it reinforces our ability, our tendency to speak in certain terms, avoid nuance, avoid deliberation.
And Judith, this is what you... Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, as you study journalism, you know, I was born into a world in which there was a newspaper that came on your in your driveway every morning. And now, oh boy, I mean, social media news is like lightning.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, right? You used to just hear about things when the paper fell on your mat, or maybe with breaking news on TV. And now I'm at work and I get a breaking news alert pop up on my screen. And that's mass media, of course. And we're not even talking about texting. I mean, how many of us, when we get a text, we immediately check our phones or our computers, and we have to feel this urge to respond right away. Because if we don't, then, oh my gosh, what is the other person going to think of me? And that means that you have to think a lot more quickly. And that could lead, that leads exactly to what, Professor Kruglansky was talking about, that speed leads to a dichotomy in thinking, that you make much more rapid judgments. I mean, again, Hamilton and Jefferson wrote some pretty mean letters to each other, but they were very well thought out, and they took their time in making their very poignant arguments, you know, and you can have text fights just using emojis. And I would argue that the two are very different.
All right, we're going to go to Kevin, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Kevin, go ahead.
Hi there. So I work in the art world with artists, and I work in a lot of exhibits. And one of the important things about fine art is ambiguity is one of its most important languages. And so the gray area, that I'm not sure, what is this? This is the language of art, and what it does is it opens doors for you to think other thoughts, mm-hmm. things you hadn't thought before. And you can't do this in a black and white world. Mm-hmm. So artists are always living in this state of ambiguity. Not that all art's ambiguous, but often this is a really important aspect that artists rely on to get people to think.
Kevin, I'm so glad you called. And I'm wondering if this is why I've been craving art and museums recently. Judith, go ahead.
I think that's a wonderful statement. And what came to mind is that to enjoy art, you have to sit with it, right? I mean, that's why museums have benches, so you can sit in front of a painting and really take it in. We don't sit anymore. We don't sit and be still. I mean, we try to with meditation apps and whatnot, which then I'm wondering, does that defeat the purpose? But we just don't live in a world where people are comfortable just being. And but I think you're right. To be creative, to be truly creative, you need to be okay with the gray, and you need to be able to just be still. And I sometimes wonder on days when I worry about the world if we've lost that entirely. I hope not, but I do worry about that.
Aria.
Yeah. Also wanted to add that, you know, because this rat race for significance, for standing out, for being successful is very burdensome, there is a reaction to that. The mindfulness movement that issues from Buddhism and Oriental philosophies, that the idea of detaching yourself of suppressing your great motivation to be special. And I think art and the ambiguity that art displays is another part of a counterforce that leads us to contemplate, to consider, to explore. And so I think, you know, that pressure of communicating and being successful and performing all the time is very burdensome. And there are counterforces in the culture that try to alleviate that. Many people, or, you know, a number of people are leaving the rat race and exploring alternative ways of being, resettling perhaps in Maine or Vermont or some other wonderful place, away from New York City and Manhattan and the, you know, the kind of rough and tumble and the quick pace where you have to be on and perform all the time. So I think art is a wonderful way of getting people away from you know, that kind of pressure.
I, as someone who lives in Maine, I can definitely agree that we've seen a lot of folks move to Maine for the peace and quiet. But, and I love the idea of counterforces. The question that pessimist me asks is, how much of that is performative, right? How many posts do you see on Instagram or videos on TikTok that have hashtag mindfulness? And that's a video of somebody sitting in the grass watching the lake. Look at me being mindful. So they're being mindful, but they're also doing it as a way to perform. So if you're doing that, are you really embracing the ambiguity, or are you just showing off that you can look like you're being ambiguous?
It's so interesting, Judy, because, you know, in psychology, we have a lot of research on significance, on competition, on social comparison. But there is a new line of research that is really taking off on awe, on, you know, whereas the significance part is trying to stand out. Awe is connecting with people, connecting with the world, connecting with nature. And the two exist in a kind of tension, uneasy balance. So, for example, you know, I'm now in Italy in a wonderful place and people are taking pictures. And so on the one hand, they enjoy the nature, they enjoy the lake, the mountains. On the other hand, they take pictures to show to their friends at home, look what I am, you know, look where I am, how important I am, enjoying all this. You go to an opera, you enjoy the music, but the next moment you think, oh, wow, look how cultured I am. Right. I am at the opera. And so I think, you know, both sides exist in this uneasy balance. But I think when you get tired of significance, tired of the rat race, you tend to orient to the other side. Yes.
Kevin, thank you for starting this part of the conversation, and thank you for calling into Maine Calling. There's an email here from Rob. When I was on a debate team in high school, we were allowed to pick a subject which we were passionate about. Then we were assigned the opposite position and had to research and defend the opposite position. I hated it, but it taught me a lesson I still remember, to try to see the other side. And I think so many people had experiences like that. What I'm thinking, though, and Rob, I'm so glad you sent the email, but that doesn't that still set up that there are two sides to an issue and not maybe multiple ways of looking at an issue? Judith.
So I want to point out, I had to do that assignment too, and I absolutely hated it because they didn't spring it on us until after we had presented our view. Yes. I mean, it does pose the problem that it makes it seem like there are just two sides when there's not. At the same time, it introduces young adults to the notion that, hey, maybe your opinion is not the only opinion, right? It's right around a college student age that most students discover, oh, maybe this is not the truth, but maybe this is just my truth. And that is a first step to recognizing that there are multiple sides to an issue. So this activity, even though it's really binary, it still is a good first step to seeing, okay, maybe my opinion isn't the only one. So it forces you to consider other sides and also other sources.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the idea that there is only one truth is related to this idea that you are right and therefore you are significant, therefore you are important. Once you have to consider the other side, it feels so bad because it implies that maybe you are not so important, you are not right, and maybe there is another way of looking at it. And in a culture where significance is, you know, the most important thing, that is threatening, that there is another side to the story. But if we suppress that idea that we all have to stand out and acknowledge that there are other people who also are, you know, are owed respect and dignity, that kind of reduces the difficulty of acknowledging the other side of the story.
So I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, nuance takes humility, and humility mm-hmm. is not rewarded in our society anymore.
I actually, one of the things, key words I wrote down a minute ago was vulnerability, because I think to communicate in a nuanced way, you have to show that you're vulnerable, right? You have to admit, I don't know enough about this to have an opinion, or you have to admit I was wrong. And I think that that's something we struggle with. Arye?
I think, you know, our culture is significance-driven, hubris-driven, and therefore it's so difficult for us to acknowledge the other side. And I think humility is exactly that. It reduces the me, you know, the kind of self-exaggerated self-focus, and it allows the other person also to have dignity, and it's a kind of exchange, mutual respect. And I think that's so important in society, and it has to be cultivated. It has to be cultivated in schools, in communities, everywhere, in the political discourse, because that allows us to have a community, to have a cohesive society. Otherwise, it's fragmented. It's us versus them. So it starts with communication, but it ramifies to the kind of place, the kind of society we have.
Right. Go ahead, Judith.
I was going to say, it also connects to the idea of assuming another person has your best interests at heart or has the best intentions, right? Which we are also not very good at. We tend to assume that someone else might be out to get us, if you will, whereas assuming that everyone wants what's best for our community, we just have different takes at it, also requires a certain level of humility about your own points of view.
We'll go to Isaac calling from Auburn. Hi, Isaac. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, it's very interesting. But everything we're talking about is almost in the context of online only. And I just wanted to bring a point of view as a parent. When we're raising our children, I have two small children, three and five. And when we're out and about, I try to teach them critical thinking, which is what we call it. And so maybe certain rules can be bent a little bit, something like no touching or employees only. I might lift them up to show them through the window of the back room so they can explore, they can see what it looks like, and bend the rules just a little bit so that they can continue their foster their curiosity and learn about the world, instead of having to adhere strictly to these social guidelines and you know, be so afraid of making a faux pas. As long as they're learning, you know, I want to try to encourage that and foster it.
Isaac, I'm going to pull one word that you said out of there, and it's going to be curiosity. I'll start with you, Professor Kruglansky. Is curiosity lost when people have locked in views, when people see the world in black and white?
Absolutely. And there is tons of research that show that people who have this great need for closure are therefore less curious, less creative, less able to imagine things that are different from the current reality. So yes, cognitive closure is the enemy of exploration and of curiosity. And people who feel comfortable with uncertainty, people who feel that uncertainty has a potential for wonderful things to happen, they are able to be creative, they are able to be imaginative, they are able to find the silver lining in every cloud, and those who are not are stuck with the current status quo and try to defend it at all costs. So I think curiosity and exploration are very important. It's not, in my understanding of psychology, it's not something that you can just teach. I think it has to be based on an attitude of accepting oneself or accepting one's, you know, place in the world and feeling secure. And it starts with the earliest childhood, you know, feeling secure attachment to one's parents, feeling supported, feeling that one matters. That allows later on to face uncertainty, to critically think about things, to be curious, to explore.
And I just wanted to add, I wanted to add to that, social media really doesn't help, because when you see, you know, kids or even adults, we're scrolling through social media, but algorithms are programmed to show us what we like to see. So we end up seeing the same type of content over and over and over again. You know, like I clicked on a reel of dressage once and now I get nothing but horse reels. So I may feel like I'm exploring, but I'm not. I'm exposed to the same slice of the world over and over again. So if I can make a pitch for, you know, getting them out into the world and away from their phones, this would be it.
Isaac, thank you for calling in. We do need to take another break. This is Maine Calling, and we are talking about the need for nuance. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the need for nuance. We are talking with University of Maryland psychology professor R.A.A. Kruglansky and University of Maine communications professor Judith Rosenbaum. If you're quick, you might be able to get in with your question or comment. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have what would generally be considered liberal views, I guess. But one of the things I've noticed is that in a lot of ways, once liberals, you know, liberal folks, all enlightened and everything, once they get the bit in their teeth, they become an awful lot like what we complain about with conservatives. I have the answer. You need to come along to my answer. I understand why a lot of conservatives complain about how policies are implemented, you know, with big brother kind of tactics. I get it. You know, you have to bring people along. And I'm afraid anybody that feels enlightened often feels like, well, I have the answer. And, you know, everybody else doesn't get it. And somehow I've got to force them in. And it doesn't work like that. We can't have everything we want.
Oh, Rolling Stones. Mike, I'm not going to sing on the air, but R.A.A., this is really the crux of the bigger conversation in this country right now.
Yes, I think that, you know, people want to stand out, to be significant, and ideological positions are a primary means for feeling significant. Ideology is based on values, and if you serve those values or represent those values or implement those values, you feel like you are a good person. But the problem with ideology is that it suppresses alternative points of view. It fixates you on this one thing, whether it be liberal ideology, progressive ideology, or conservative ideology. Once you're stuck on it, and once you feel extremely virtuous by adhering to it, you tend to ignore alternative points of view. You tend to perceive people who have alternative opinions as being wrong, if not evil. And I think so. That's ideology. That's the danger of ideology. And right now, in this race for significance, we become polarized, ideologically polarized, and adhering to points of view that are so extreme that they preclude everything else from being considered. And I think that's the danger that is fragmenting our society, on both the conservative and the progressive extremes.
Mike, thank you so much. Go ahead, Judith.
And I was just thinking that, and again, coming back to social media, really facilitates that, right? Because on social media, we can connect just with people who think like us, creating these echo chambers that basically mirror our own opinions back to us and make us feel like, yeah, we are totally right. And of course, everybody who doesn't agree with us is wrong, because look around me, everybody around me feels this way. And we don't realize that we are just in a little bubble. And that's just really tricky about how we communicate these days.
We'll go to Kelsey calling from Phippsburg. Hi, Kelsey. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am wondering what the experts would say about if we want to relate with people who are really fixed in significance mindset and we're coming from a more nuanced approach, what's the best way to approach relating with someone who's really fixed in that significance mindset?
Aria?
I think the best way is to give people respect, to you know, show them that you give them dignity, you value them, you find them significant. Once you give them significance, once you assure them that in our eyes they matter, they merit consideration, they merit a serious attention, they will be more willing to listen to your point of view. There is research that shows that once you affirm people's significance, they are opening up to alternative possibilities. They are willing to listen. They are, you reduce their threat of being insignificant in this competition. You know, people approach you with suspicion. Maybe you will not appreciate me as much as I would like to be appreciated. Maybe you will not recognize how important I am. Once you calm them down on that regard, in that regard, they're going to be more ready to entertain alternative possibilities and listen to you respectfully.
So say to somebody something as simple as, I so value our friendship, or what you think is important to me, here's why I feel differently, is a much better way to say something. You're nodding, so any other tips? Any black and white?
What do you think of that possibility? I know that, you know, I respect what you think, and that makes a lot of sense. But what do you think of that nuance, of that possibility, that way of communicating? I mean, Judith knows better than I, but that way of communicating kind of reduces the tension of who is right and who is wrong.
Go ahead, Judith.
It also, I think, centers on finding your shared humanity, right? What are people's truly underlying motivations? They want a safe world for their children. They want a good future for their children. They want their family to be fed and clothed. And those are things we all share. So figuring out which one of those motivations inspires people with whom you might not agree, and then finding common ground. I feel that way too, right? We both want the same thing. Let's see if we can find common ground on how we can get to that same thing.
Kelsey, thank you. We're going to go to Cape Elizabeth and Genevieve. Hi, Genevieve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for this conversation. I am a pediatrician married to a teacher, and we think a lot about these with our children, about the idea of outcome versus process. And I see that outcome as sort of the positions that we have versus the process and the conversation that's arriving there. And I see this in our adolescents, in this epidemic we have of anxiety, that they feel this need to know exactly who they are and what they think, and to be uncertain feels anxiety provoking. But thinking on what you guys have talked about today, I think it's so important to say that you can be confident in uncertainty. You can feel a confidence in that place, and that being part of the process can be the goal rather than the outcome. So just thinking about that, both in our politics, in our kids, and in what we're all facing.
I see this in my undergraduates, the exact same feeling, right? Like, we have to know who we are, and I don't like uncertainty, and teaching them it's okay to not know who you are. Like, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And I'm leaning towards firefighter right now. And that's totally fine, right? Like, you can grow old with uncertainty. And I think that's sort of a paradigm shift we have to try to pass on to young adults.
What we find is that to the extent that you feel good about yourself, you're willing to entertain uncertainty. And that can come from your life history of outcomes. People who had a positive history of outcomes are more willing to embrace uncertainty. Those who had a abusive childhood history of negative outcomes are very leery of uncertainty, but also events that happen in the situation. After a series of successes, people are more willing to accept uncertainty as opposed to after a series of failures on tasks. We experimentally expose people to a series of successes or a series of failures, and then expose them to an uncertain situations. And we find that people who had successes in the immediate past are willing to entertain uncertainty and explore it to a greater extent. And that's, you know, you can make that person feel successful by virtue of you and of your expressing appreciation for them, giving them respect, showing them that you are that you admire them, you really value their opinion, and that allows them to entertain uncertainty to a greater extent.
Genevieve, thank you for your question. I have an email here from Avery. I know, Aria, you need to go, but I'm going to try to slip this one in. Avery says, aren't you just describing religion, exclusivity, perceived significance, refusing other people's perspective?
Well, religion is a very powerful system that really addresses the three fundamental motivations that people have. It allows you to be significant. You know, it has guidelines as to what you should do to be virtuous. It also allows you to have awe, the idea of divinity. So, you know, we talked about these two needs for significance and awe. And the third need is connectedness with people. And the idea of congregation in religion allows you to do that. And because religion combines virtue, significance, and the congregation, it is such a powerful force. And that's why it has governed and continues to govern people's lives to such a great extent.
Well, Aria Kruglansky, I so appreciate you joining us for the hour. I know you need to run, but what an honor to have you back on Maine Calling. We're going to go to Trish in Brunswick. Hi, Trish. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I heard something brilliant on Maine Calling a couple of weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, which I've been using with out-of-town company all summer long. And it is basically just when you're in, especially in political, you know, conversations, you know, bordering on arguments, never say you're wrong. Always say, I see it differently. Are you willing to listen? And it's amazing how many people just sort of stopped and said, yeah, I'll listen. And it just, I heard it on Maine Calling, and thank you for whoever said it. I can't remember who it was, but it's brilliant.
I can't remember either, but I'm so happy that we were useful to you. Judith, you're smiling.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's great. One of the things I tell my students is speak in terms of I messages. And it sounds like that's exactly what you picked up on, right? I think, I feel, and not I think you're wrong, but I see this differently. Or tell me why you think this way, right? So really the I approach makes it much more dialogic, opens it up for conversation, makes the other person feel seen and heard, and makes them, like Aria said, makes them feel like they matter, like you're seeing them and not just their opinion. So I want everybody to use that going forward.
Trish, thank you. Let's see, we'll try to squeeze in one more call. Go to Rocky, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Rocky, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted your point earlier about the algorithm creating this little narrow slice of the worldview, and it just reminds me how important it is to go to newsprint, because it exposes you to all these other stories that you normally wouldn't even bother reading.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rocky. Your audio isn't great. We can tell you're on the road, but I would say the same for just an old-fashioned TV news program, Judith, is that whether you're picking up a newspaper or watching a half-hour news program or an hour-long like NewsHour, you're going to be exposed to things that maybe an algorithm on social media is not going to show you.
Exactly. I encourage all my students to check out the news media bias chart and find out where their favorite news channel lives on the right or the left, and then pick a couple news channels from the other side of the chart. So on the other side of the political spectrum, and start following those. Number one, it'll make your algorithm shift a little bit, and it will expose you to stuff that you didn't think about. It may expose you to things you don't agree with either. And that's okay, right? Because as Aria was saying, we have to learn to live in that discomfort.
Rocky, thank you for your call. We're going to end with a very quick email. Carl is suggesting a bumper sticker. One person's nuance is another's ambiguity. So there we go. Something to ponder as you go through your day. And I want to thank our guests. We said goodbye to Aria Kruglansky just a couple minutes ago, social psychologist, distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland. Also with us, Judith Rosenbaum, associate professor at UMaine's Department of Communications and Journalism. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. As always, you can go to the Maine Calling website to sign up for our free weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs. That's mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.